Alex Miller. It is great to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Fiona. Thanks for having us along.
Now, I'm about three quarters of the way through reading Cold
good
Creek.
Enough. It's not good enough, Fiona. You're in trouble.
But I'm kind of glad I haven't finished it yet, because just off air during the news, you were telling me there is a big twist at the end, which I'm concerned I'd give away if I had read it to the end.
This is a woman rationalising about not having finished the book. It's actually better to have not finished it, she's saying. But you're in trouble, mate. When you finish it, you'll know why.
Yeah, right. But the tension at the moment in the book, and this book, there's a lot of tension in this book, and that tension is real for me as a reader at the moment. So I feel if that tension was resolved, when I get to the end, I might give something away.
How do you know it'll be resolved?
I'm assuming it'll be resolved. I don't know because I haven't finished it yet. Look, I'm happy with where I'm at. Let's start with a premise and the setting, perhaps, of Coal Creek. Why did you decide to set this book in the Australian scrub?
Well, I don't want to be smart about it, but the book set itself there. I mean, the idea of the story that came to me was set up there in the north of Queensland, in the hinterland, country that I'm very familiar with. I used to work there as a boy, and I repeatedly go back these days and have great friends up there. So it's country like around Mount Coolin and Nebo and those sort of places where there's not really much in the way of tourist attractions or facilities. You've really got to know somebody. And if you go out sort of south of Mount Coolin into the scrub, it's pretty poor country. It's, as I think somewhere in there Bobby Blue says, it's just sort of mined out and not much good except for a few scrubber cattle. And that's where they live and work, these people. And I know them and I love them. And this is a story from their lives. It's not a story that's got any basis in fact. It's a story that just came to me. But it's the kind of story that just, I mean, it just felt as though it had happened. When his voice, the voice of the narrator, it's narrated by Bobby Blue, who's a semi-literate stockman. Someone called him a cattleman, but actually, you know, he's a stockman. He's a ringer. He's a worker. And his dad dies, and things kind of, his dad had a driving plant, and those days are sort of over for him. So he's looking around for a new job. The stations had put him on, but he's probably, yes, needs a bit of a change. So he starts working for the new constable as his offsider. And that's when things start to really go wrong. It's a mistake. He shouldn't be doing that job, to be honest. And he's got a friend, Ben Tobin, who is one of those guys, and this is true of girls too, they say, she's trouble or he's trouble. Doesn't mean to say they're bad people, but it does mean to say they're going to stick up for themselves and not be put upon by anybody. So they tend to be trouble. Trouble tends to come to them, and that's Bobby's best mate. And Bobby is deeply, deeply engaged with his friend, and he's loyal to his friend. And when his friend and the constable have a serious problem that gets worse with time and misunderstandings, because the constable comes from the coast, doesn't really have a good idea of the values of the people of the hinterland. They have their own very strong values, their strong ways, their principles, and they're getting on fine. And he comes in and has the idea, I'll sort these people out, straighten it all out, get the records right. He's wanting to be efficient. He's a good man. He's a decent man. But he gets it wrong.
And Bobby Blue finds himself in the middle of this because he has an allegiance to his friend, Ben Tobin, but also because he is this new constable's offsider and has a job with him and indeed lives on that family's property and also has a very special relationship with one of the daughters of the constable. So he finds himself in this situation and the tension just builds up and builds up to the point where I'm at now and I can't wait to know what happens. But as I say, it's probably good I don't. But it is a really interesting way that you've written this book because of that tension just being there. From the moment you open the book, you know something bad happens, but you don't know what. And then you can see paths leading to something bad happening, but then you don't know what, and you're just dying to know as you're turning the pages.
I wonder why you know from the very beginning. Everybody says that. And they also say that as soon as you open it up and start reading, Bobby's there for you. He certainly was there for me. You know, I was really very delighted to get this. It's like a gift to get a story like that that comes out of somebody else's mouth in this way. And I mean, the guy is semi-literate. He's an uneducated bloke. And I used to be, when I worked up there as a kid, I had a crap education in those days. And since then, of course, I've got a much better education and become an educated person. But those days I wasn't. But he's an honest, decent guy. And in fact, the little girl teaches him. She's 12, 13-year-old. And she teaches him to read and write, otherwise he wouldn't be able to write this book. And he hasn't got much of a vocabulary, his grammar's not correct, so there's no interference from me, the grown-up, educated guy. I can't interfere with his story.
Well, I was going to ask you about channeling someone who only has rudimentary writing skills, that you're effectively pretending to be him writing this novel. And how difficult is that, Alex, as a highly skilled writer now, to write with prose that is sometimes not quite right or sometimes slang?
Well, I think people have said that the book is haunted by my presence, by my intelligence, and also that the voice of Bobby carries all the nuances without being complex. And this is one of the things about language. I've always believed the simpler the better.
And this is very simply written book because the person writing it, it's obviously you, but because it is...
It's very direct.
Bobby Blue, it is very simple language.
I mean, I would love to be able to write like that repeatedly, but of course I can't. I doubt if I'll ever quite get that one again. I mean, it's a kind of one-off thing. It's like meeting somebody. You know, people say, well, how do you know when you got the right voice for it? Well, how do you know you love your kids? You just do. You don't have to prove it.
You're very good at sort of challenging... Or I guess channeling is the word I'm looking for, channeling people through your writing and have them write the book for you in a way. You said that Bobby Blue came to you. How did he come to you?
Well, I guess, I mean, the first, it's a voice that's familiar to me, let's face it, from when I was a kid up there. I probably was like that myself. And he's a guy who, one of the underlying things that I really loved about him, and these are things you discover about your character rather than know about them, in my case anyway. I like things to be a surprise when I'm writing a book. I don't like to know everything that's going to happen or know the person intimately. I find out about their biography and their life as it goes along. And he was somebody who, his morals and his principles, he didn't get them from his dad, he got them from his mother. And in retrospect, when I look back, that's probably true of me too. And he found it impossible when it came to the crunch to do something that his mother wouldn't have approved of. She's dead in the book. At the time the book's being written, his mother has passed away. But he couldn't bring himself to do, no matter what kind of pressure is on him, he couldn't bring himself to do something that would have gone against, would have upset her. Mm. And Mum wouldn't have liked that. So it's a kind of test for him. Mm. It's a big test, in fact. It becomes an enormous test.
He talks to her as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does, yeah.
I think he hears from her, you know, not like in a ghost-like way, but just...
We do.
You know, as we do.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got dead friends or intimates, you know they remain part of your life. They don't, I mean, okay, so you don't spend your life grieving over them, but there's always, when the sort of period of grief is over, they're always going to be present to you in some way, people you've loved. And, I mean, his mother was hugely important to him.
Mm, and it's interesting because there haven't been many people in his life at all anyway.
That's
because
true.
Of the sparseness of the country that he works and the tiny town of Mount Hay.
Yeah, he worked out there with his dad. And with Ben Tobin's dad and with Ben since he was 10. Before that, he went to school. And his mother always wanted to teach him to read and write, but he was out in the camps, mustering, working. He was a worker from the age of 10. And I was a worker from the age of 15. And there are plenty of kids who are working at 10. And the book is set in 1948 after the war. initially 1948 actually carries right through. You don't know this yet because you haven't finished it, but it carries right through to 1963, I think. So you've got a bit to go.
And on the surface, as we say, Bobby Blue leads a pretty simple life. He's a simple person. He has a simple way of telling things like they are. But that simplicity, I guess, is a mirage because below the surface there is a lot going on, both in his head and in his life, however subtle that may be. Is that something that you were actively thinking about as you were writing?
Well, I admire that way of life a lot. It's a quiet way of life. Silence is important in it. And getting things done without too much yelling and shouting and gesticulating and carrying on, what we used to call rip, tear and bust when I lived up there. And the rip, tear and bust person who you see on TV and on the movies is really an amateur who gets in the way and is a bloody nuisance and is likely to injure a horse or something like that. It's quietly, things quietly, let's get it done, you know. And I think that's one of the great things about those old values of the stockmen out there. It was their life depended on getting it done quietly, not getting injured, and not taking risks when there was no need to. When you absolutely had to, okay, you might have to take a risk. But the thing was to do the job without too much chat. You can ride through the scrub with those people all day, and eventually someone will say something, and that's enough. I mean, I love that. I love the way in which silence is approved of between people, and yet communication continues to happen. So there's that understanding of communicating in the silence and trusting that your friend, your colleague, your neighbour has picked up all that stuff too, which happens so rarely in the city. It's just talk endlessly, what we're doing now.
Well, that's very true.
Yeah.
But I reckon someone out there is listening, not saying a word.
No, it's good if we don't say anything, though, because they won't even know we're here.
That's exactly
I'll
right.
think, have they gone?
I could just try a flick of the head or a glance over at you when you nod and hold up the book, but that wouldn't work at all. But it is interesting, you know, this idea of communication and that a flick of the head in the Australian scrub setting when you're, you know, out working the camps, that was the way they communicated, and that's the way Bobby Blue's been used to communicating up until this new constable comes to town from the coast and brings a different way of doing things. Even the constable he replaces, who is now not there anymore, he used to, as you write or as Bobby Blue writes, used to just let things sort themselves out. He didn't get involved. He didn't get too involved.
He didn't jump in while the heat was on.
Exactly.
He let it cool down and then he moved in. Yeah.
Whereas this new constable has a different way of working altogether.
And also he's got a bit of pressure coming from
his wife.
His wife, who is a determined woman with high principles that she's not going to change just because she lives in a new environment. The environment's going to have to change for her. That's her idea. And it's a well-meaning idea. From her understanding, she doesn't give herself time to really notice that Mount Hay's okay. It just seems very flat and dead and nothing happening to her, but she hasn't given herself time to be a member of the community, to discover what's going on. She doesn't really respect, I suppose, what's going on locally. It seems to her, on the face of it, that nothing is going on locally. And she's wrong. She just hasn't noticed. Again, it's the difference between the display of the coastal city and the lack of display out there. The town seems deserted and silent. In fact, it's not. Look closer, live more closely with it, give it a chance. They don't do that, and that's a mistake.